Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is the New York Times bestselling author Stephen Johnson, who's out with his newest book, Enemy of All Mankind, a true story of piracy, power, and history's first global manhunt. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. Stephen, the events in this book predate the golden age of pirates, Blackbeard, Calico Jack, and you open with a scene in the Indian Ocean in 1695. What monumental event transpired there that sort of was the launching point of this story?
Well, interestingly, just as a kind of coincidence, it was September 11th, 1695, and in a way there's kind of parallel that runs through the book between kind of modern-day terrorism and the pirates of this period. What happens basically is a British pirate by the name of Henry Every, who has mutinied a ship and has a kind of band of rogue pirates on board with him, attacks a massive treasure ship returning from Mecca with a bunch of religious pilgrims on it, but also a vast fortune in booty. And in a kind of surprise, through a surprising series of kind of coincidences, is able to overpower this much larger ship. They pull off this heist where they steal somewhere between $20 and $100 million worth of gold and silver and treasure. And also there are a bunch of women on the ship coming back from Mecca who are actually raped or commit suicide to avoid being raped by the pirates. And so it's both one of the most astonishing and lucrative acts of crime in the history of crime, and also this incredibly controversial, egregious act of sexual violence. And it basically reverberates around the world because of this particular configuration of events at that moment in time.
To the extent there was one, how would a typical pirate mission work at the time? I mean, would they'd steal the items, and then what would they do?
Well, one of the things that is so fascinating about pirate culture, I have a whole chapter that talks about this in the book, is the pirates were actually, if you look at the world at that particular moment in time, the system, the kind of economic system on board a pirate ship was probably the most economically, you know, progressive, egalitarian system on the face of the earth at that point. So they would write up these little kind of a pirate constitution. It was called an articles of agreement. And before they went off on their kind of journey, they would agree on all these terms. And one of the key things was that the ratio of how the booty that was eventually captured, if they were lucky enough to actually capture significant wealth, it would be shared in this very equitable way. So the captain would only get two pieces of gold versus one piece of gold for all the regular shipmen, maybe four pieces to one. But that was a very egalitarian kind of system. And they had insurance policies if you lost an arm or a foot or whatever it was. And they had a little floating democracy. So you could vote out the captain, you could vote in the quartermaster and things like that. So they had, despite the fact that they were outlaws and renegades, they had a really interesting little economic system that they developed.
And at the time, there was a difference between piracy, as we know it from the legendary stories, and privateering. What was that distinction?
Up until really the events that I talk about in Enemy of All Mankind, there was a kind of legitimate way of being a pirate, where you were not perceived to be really outside the law. And that was the technical term for this in British culture was, as you say, being a privateer. So that's what someone like Francis Drake was. Now, by our standards, if you look at what Francis Drake did, he was clearly a pirate. He would go and attack ships. He would go and, you know, rape and pillage and, you know, steal money from other people. But because he was careful not to attack other British ships, he was considered to be within this kind of zone of legitimacy. And in fact, when he came back to England after, you know, a number of his adventures, he was knighted and he bought a fancy house and became kind of part of the almost aristocracy. So that was the world that Henry Every kind of was born into. But what changed was that increasingly the British economy was revolving around global trade. Specifically the East India Company, which was making a vast fortune bringing back these beautiful Indian fabrics and selling them. And there was this realization after these crimes that if the British were going to be increasingly a nation of kind of traders and part of this global economic system, they couldn't permit pirates to go off and rape and pillage at whim. And so this was a real transition point where the British government basically had to decide we are no longer a nation of pirates.
Henry Avery is obviously a huge part of this story. He grew up in England, and at the time there was something in England called the Impress Service, and I was intrigued by that. What was the Impress Service?
It was kind of a mix of what we would think of as a draft, in terms of a military draft, and a state-sponsored kidnapping. In the sense that you could just be walking around the street and, you know, be an able-bodied, 20-year-old man, and people would come and say, you're going to join the British Navy, and otherwise we're going to arrest you. And here are the terms. You can take this deal, or you can go to jail, or you can take a much worse deal. And so there were two things basically that were happening. There were a lot of people who had been kind of disgorged by the new economic system that used to live in kind of feudal estates, who were just kind of wandering around, more or less homeless. And there was this need for a big supply of sailors to support the British Navy, which was growing at an incredible clip. And so we think that it's possible that Henry Avery eventually, as a young man, joined the Royal Navy. We don't know whether he was impressed into service by the press gangs, as they were called, or whether he did it voluntarily.
And Henry Avery, it's not like somebody is born and decides, I want to grow up and be a pirate. How did he get into this business?
Well, that's one of the things that's interesting about his career. I mean, he was, for a time, the most famous, notorious pirate in the world. But one, we don't know very much about his life other than the events between 1693 and 1696 or so. But the general evidence suggests that he was not a pirate. He was some kind of slave trader, maybe what was known as an interloper in the slave trade. So he was doing borderline criminal activity, but wasn't technically doing piracy. But he ends up on board a legitimate operation called the Spanish Expedition Shipping, which was going off to, he was going to be the first mate of one of the ships. And the expedition got hung up in Spain with the bureaucratic snafus, and they sat in the harbor in a Spanish kind of coastal town for months and months and months, unable to get paid. And so ultimately he decided to lead this mutiny. And he takes off with the ship and decides to, embrace the pirate lifestyle. And in that, he decides, one, to sail from Spain all the way over to the mouth of the Red Sea, which was an incredibly bold thing to do. And then, luckily for him, happens to pull off this extraordinary heist. So he basically commits, kind of one major act of piracy and then retires.
And, the way that this all worked out, he was somewhat popular in his day. Would he have been something akin to Jesse James in the 19th century here in the United States?
Well, I think in some ways, yes. There is that kind of familiar idea of the criminal who's of kind of a popular hero. But the other part about it you have to remember is there was almost no. In some ways, he's like a. Almost like a Steve Jobs-like figure, in the sense that there were very few figures in the cultural landscape at that point of people who had self-made a fortune for themselves, right? They're just the people who had money were people who'd been born into it, and there weren't a bunch of entrepreneurs who'd come up from nothing and started a company and done all these things. Like, that was just not part of the landscape, and so pirates, amplified by the new media systems that were developing around that period. These were examples of somebody, he was born into nothing, he was just a Devonshire commoner, and now he's one of the most famous people in the world, and he's rich but beyond imagination. And so the mystique of that was very powerful, not just because they were exotic criminals, but because they actually had come up from nothing and made a name for themselves in the world.
Your book also details the trial of the pirates in London. What kind of records still exist for a researcher to view?
Well, this was one of the things about the book that made it so great as a historian writing this, which was when some of the pirates were captured, the British government put on this show trial, basically, where they wanted to, you know, make it clear to the world, and particularly to India, that they did not tolerate these acts of piracy. And so they hired a transcriber to keep a, you know, very elaborate transcript, word by word, and then they hired a printer to print it. And that, you know, there's a 40-page trial transcript that exists to this day. I have it, like, on my computer as a PDF, right? And so every word in the trial is recorded, and so I'm able to quote in the book from, you know, every little moment of the trial as it develops and all the interesting back and forth between the pirates and the prosecutors. But also, they tell the story of their adventures, and so they describe everything they've done in quite, you know, elaborate detail, including what people said to each other at various different points. And so it gives the book, it's this really lucky thing where the book has all these very cinematic scenes where these characters are talking to each other with direct quotes, but none of it is made up. Every single quote in the book comes from either a deposition or this trial itself.
The title of your book, Enemy of All Mankind, there's a certain political or legal significance to that term at the time, right?
It was invented as a category to deal with this curious legal loophole that the pirates had, which was that they committed most of their crimes in international waters, and it wasn't clear who had jurisdiction over them in those in that kind of geography. And so, but they were becoming increasingly, as we've talked about, a major threat to the whole economy. And so they invented this legal term to say, okay, these people are, their crimes are so atrocious that even if they are not committing them, you know, inside the boundaries of our nation state, if we capture them, we can bring them to justice, you know, back home in London. And that term actually is carried through history, and now it is actually used to describe terrorists. And, you know, a lot of the legal language that was used to extradite terrorists after 9/11 referred specifically to the terrorists as enemies of all mankind. So there's a direct link in terms of the legal status between pirates and terrorists.
We just scratched the surface of this amazing story, and he's put it together so well here. He's Stephen Johnson. The book is Enemy of All Mankind, A True Story of Piracy, Power, and History's First Global Manhunt. Books available now wherever your fine books are sold. Stephen, just an amazingly entertaining and interesting book of history to read, and thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thanks for saying that.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
I am the very model of a modern Major General. Life, information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England and the coat of...